It's Friday, and it's a very special edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. And today we're going to focus on the election, and this is such a very special edition that it's actually Thursday that we're videotaping this and ready for distribution. So, Jer, how are you this week?
About as good as one could do hanging in the, on this tightrope election, right?
Yeah, I've been asked if I've been sleeping, and each evening it kind of qualifies more as a nap than it does as a full night's sleep. But hey, this is what we do. And so a lot happened this week. Let's get right into it. So I'm going to first recap the election briefly. And then secondly, I'm going to answer the question I've been answering all week, which is what happened with the polls. You've kind of been answering it much of this week as well. So first of all, what happened? Well, the important thing is we don't have a winner yet. We have a putative winner. It looks like Joe Biden is going to win. It looks like Donald Trump is going to challenge it. But there are automatic recounts and certifications that take place. So what we know is that it was a very close, hard-fought election, enough to say that Donald Trump and Donald Trumpism were not repudiated. And at the same time that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party were not given a strong endorsement or a mandate to govern, it looks as of this moment as if it's a split Congress, but then the jury's still deliberating as the votes are still being counted. In any event, even if that remote chance that the Democrats do gain a majority of Congress, it would be a bare majority. But for now, I think it's safer to suggest that we have split government. So what does any of this mean? Well, what we discovered is that the number one issue that voters went to the polls with was the economy. And on the economy, Donald Trump overwhelmed Joe Biden. The other issues were race relations, in which 91% of those who said race relations, that was the number two issue, in fact, 91% voted for Joe Biden. Biden overwhelmed on uniting the country and on showing good judgment. Donald Trump on the economy and being a strong leader. So you kind of have an evenness there, which suggests that unless somebody makes a move or two people make a move, that is Biden and Trump, that we're not only going to have split government, we're going to have mean government as well. With all of that said, the demographics of who showed up were pretty much what we at Zogby expected them to be. In fact, we had less whites in our sample than any other of the pollsters, and there were even fewer whites, according to the exit poll, that actually showed up. So we were correct in our demographics. Other, and I'm going to talk more about the polls in a second, but just in terms of makeup, other polls had the party spread going into the election as much wider between Democrats and Republicans than we did. In fact, the exit polls validated our pre-election party identification at 38, 34, 28 on the nose. So if there was any place where we maybe skipped a beat a little bit, it was with age, as you pointed out. My fault, I had more young people than actually were a percentage of the turnout, fewer older people than the actual turnout. On the other hand, there were 160 million voters that turned out. We were anticipating 150 million. Mm-hmm. Both sides got their vote out. And so for all of the beating up of the American people about the health of our democracy, my God, 65 plus percent, almost 66% of the eligible voters turned out. And that is, at least as far as we know, a big record. Mm-hmm. So everybody won, and it's now remaining one item somebody's got to lose.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about, because this is the question that everybody's raising. Immediately yesterday, the day after the election, it was the polls were wrong. The polls were wrong. And, you know, nonstop media requests for what's the explanation? Why are the polls wrong? What do you have to say about that? And let's give our listeners and viewers some understandings of some key differences between different polling firms. I mean, let's not say all pollsters were wrong, right? So I'd like to hear your thoughts, and I can follow up.
So this is not a new issue. You know, I've been in contention with my colleagues, particularly my New York colleagues that work with the networks and the major newspapers, my academic colleagues as well. And as you know, I'm a recovering academic, so so I could talk this way. There is a tendency to oversample Democrats, and I believe that a lot of that has to do with an outmoded technology, the telephone, landline telephone, and the cell phone. Very simply, I think what's going on is that we're at a stage now, socially and culturally, where people are a little more reluctant to talk on the telephone and to give personal information. And hey, these days my party identification is pretty controversial.
Yeah.
So the question then becomes, who is it who's calling me, and why right up front am I telling you whether I'm a Democrat or Republican? I think that the industry has been very unwilling to innovate and to change with new technologies. So yes, we went from 100% landline telephone calling when it made sense. These days, 70% of calls in a nationwide or a political survey need to be done by cell phone, and the cell phone is a terrible tool for market research or for political polling. You have discovered that in the several years that you've been working here. You're limited in the number of questions that you can ask. The response rates are beyond dismal.
It's invasive.
Invasive. And we need to ask more than who are you going to vote for, goodbye. We need to ask personal information. And who are you? What are your values? And now you're annoying people. So those are, I think, two of the major problems that I've identified. Mm-hmm. And I think the industry, and this is my final point, it's not just that they don't adapt to technological innovation. I think that they fight technological innovation. Mm-hmm. I think combined with being in a bubble, I mean, a lot of them are in New York.
Yeah.
A lot of them are in D.C.
Yeah.
A lot of them never see a Trump sign. And plus the fact that anyone who comes up with new technologies is immediately viewed as counter to the establishment that dominate this industry.
Mm-hmm.
There had to be a reckoning. And clearly, not 2016. I've said over and over again the polls were fine. One day we'll have a reckoning. November 3rd this year, we had our reckoning.
I have to say that was very diplomatic with the way you, and it was spot on, but you know, maybe I'm just a little bit more polemic, but I zero right in on the echo chamber. I zero right in on the bias. The methodological aspects of it is very true. I'll get into that, but I mean, you know, right off the bat, I mean, just pick your network. I mean, for me, election night, I was watching NBC News. I was going all over the place, but I always went back to NBC, and it was just fascinating to listen to Chuck Todd and watch him at the map, and you know, going over state by state and what's going on, and using the language. If we get this state, we. Really, Chuck? I didn't know that you were a Democratic operative. It's not just NBC, it's the networks in general, including Fox News. Cheerleading, advocacy, activism, that's not journalism. long gone are the days of the journalist where you were left scratching your head saying, I wonder whether he's conservative or liberal. That's mm-hmm. out the window. So I'm talking about pundits, right? But, you know, pollsters are pundits too. And as you, you know, mentioned the geography aspect of it, being in an echo chamber. I mean, if you live in Manhattan and all of your friends are from Manhattan or the tri-state area, you probably don't get out too much to what they call flyover country. And if you do, you probably are, you know, look down on it or despise. And so there's a real lack of understanding, you know, being from those power centers and you know, having most of your friends in power centers, is that you don't really understand the other side. And that lends itself to bias, and it lends itself to the kind of analysis of, you know, how can they think like that? How can they vote like that? And then it's just beyond that. You know, we talked about this last week. You know, you were mentioning Trafalgar Group and how, you know, he was making the mistake of not only just polling, but cheerleading for Trump. And so, I mean, you know, you have to put aside your biases. And really, at the end of the day, it's about the desire to get it right, and less so have your candidate, the one you personally prefer, win. And so, I mean, you know, we had Biden in our final poll ahead by 6. Of course, factoring in the margin of error can bring it down to a 3-point race. And that alone right there was enough for us to say, this is too close to call. And I'm proud to say that we've been saying that mm-hmm. all along, that this was too close to call. I wrote about in the 11th issue of the Intelligencer, which I really encourage people to read, because even though we think the election is done, and we think, you know, last week is last week, or 2 days ago is 2 days ago, it's not. This is going to play out for a very long time. But I looked at the horse race question, and I pointed out the fact that in our poll on Sunday, November 1st, 4% were telling us that they were going to vote for Joe Jorgensen. Now, I believe that on Sunday, that 4% truly believed that they were going to vote for Joe Jorgensen. But I knew that come election day, going into the booth, America was at a crossroads, and the choice was the reset or the anchor. That was the title of the 11th issue of the Intelligencer, that when they went into that booth, whether it was consciously or unconsciously, they knew that America was at a critical crossroads. And something told me that Joe Jorgensen wasn't going to get 4%. So that brings the race even tighter. And so it actually turned out, I think the exit polls show that Jorgensen got about 1%. So we were spot on. We were saying all along that this is too close to call. But at the end of the day, what I think where we shined in our analysis was that we didn't let our personal politics seep into it. We weren't cheerleading. We weren't saying using language like we, if we get this state, you know, like mm-hmm. some pundits were doing.
That raises a lot of things, you know. Some is just how out of touch some of our colleagues are. I did a Bloomberg radio interview, and the anchor, you know, said to me, well, you know, how do you handle the issue of getting, too many Democrats or shy Trump voters. That was it. It was shy Trump voters. And I said, well, you know, you really can't. I'm not going to follow up with, did you just lie to me? You know, but he said, well, one pollster said that I counter that by asking the question, what do you think, who do you think your neighbor is going to vote for? What do you think of that? I said, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. I said, I've got 8 neighbors, mm-hmm. all of whom are voting for Trump.
Yeah.
If anything makes me vote for Biden, it'll be those 8 neighbors and those ugly signs that are in front. That has no impact. Sometimes pollsters try to get a little too cute. I've got to tell you that I think that this is a real problem this time. I think that the industry is in crisis, and I think that first and foremost, what the industry has to do is be honest with itself and say, we have to follow science, but we're studying people.
Yeah.
We're not pulling data points. We're pulling people. We have to get more into, as we already do, and as you do in the intelligentsia, what's the heart and soul? What are the values of the people that we're actually polling? You know, when I wake up on election morning every 4 years and I see the Democrat has a 91% chance of winning, and then in the course of the day, as you start to see the patterns, it's like the national debt ticker on Times Square,
yeah.
You know, for 91, 90, 89, 88, yeah. So that by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's a 46% chance. I say to myself, that's useless.
Mm-hmm.
That's too much information and useless information. My final point is we need to be honest with ourselves about what we are delivering. Is this a close race or not a close race?
Mm-hmm.
What are the possible scenarios if this happens versus that happens? What's the trend line? And this is why the polls were actually good in 2016. Hillary Clinton's numbers are dropping a point a day, you know, the last 10 days. So what if the final poll comes out and says she wins the state by 2 points and ends up losing it by half a point? The poll caught the trend line, and that's all that we really need to know.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be more honest in our profession.
Well, what if someone comes out and says that the networks are essentially propaganda, and that they're what they're polling for is to project an image or a notion that is not. And I mean, consistently, a lot of networks had Biden ahead by double digits over the course of months. I mean, we were seesawing. You know, mm-hmm. We had Biden ahead by 7, by 2, by 3, back and forth, which I thought was more capturing the reality of it, that it wasn't set in stone. But I mean, if you only followed the major networks, you were going into the election thinking that this is an easy win for Biden. Well, I mean, is it really just telephone, or is it really their personal, beyond their personal bias seeping into it? Are they trying to alter the outcome?
No. In all honesty, absolutely not. And I won't cast any aspersions that way. I do think that they come in with preconceived notions, mm-hmm. but I think they're too limited in their data.
Mm-hmm.
Collection, and I think that they're not flexible enough to do what we do. And this has always been an argument that we've had with mainstream colleagues. We apply a weight for party identification. They don't. They treat party identification as something that's ephemeral,
mm-hmm.
that just changes. It depends on how I feel. And I've always felt that party is a lead variable. It's as important to me, whether I'm a strong Democrat or not, I still filter my information a certain way. And it is a determinant in how I vote, or even who I reject, who I'm going to vote for. And in that sense, then, you've got to get party identification right. And if you don't get that right, then
everything else falls apart.
Everything else falls apart.
I mean, look, I have more that I want to say about polling and our polls and the polls in general, but I think people are tuning in now because they want to know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so why don't you go first? I mean, how do you see this playing out? Where we are now, and is it weeks? Is it months? And what's your general take on where this goes?
Well, first of all, I do think that Biden wins. You know, it's going to take a while, I think, for Donald Trump to lose. And I do think that we have begun to see prominent Republicans already, including Republicans who have supported him, say, you know, let's back off. This is not good for the party, let alone for the country. So I think ultimately as what happened in 2000, we'll have a new president and have a new president of a different party by December, if not by Thanksgiving. With that said, I think that Joe Biden is a man of experience. He's a man of Washington, but he also does not come in with the fundamental negative baggage that any number of other people could have come in. I think a majority of Americans actually like him now, and that's very, very important. So what will he be? He could be a transitional, not transformational, but a transitional caretaker, meaning I'm the old guy who's coming in with steady hand of experience. I'm going to calm things down, and I'm going to talk to Mitch McConnell. I'm going to do better with Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership than Barack Obama did. That's one piece of it. Another piece of it is that he sets the table for millennials and Gen Z and becomes the last septuagenarian president of the United States, at least for a while, and says, I'm steadying things down. You folks take over. You're the ones who are going to carry the ball on climate change and on health care reform, on income inequality, and so on. In that sense, he becomes a transformational president. The honest answer, I don't know. But I'm starting to hear from Mitch McConnell a different tone. And the tone is, does he want to be the guy who buried the Republican Party as a party that says no and was pure only with conservative principles? Or does he want to be a guy who also is a transitional figure that helps to modernize the Republican Party as a party that, hey, can compromise a little bit and welcome some diversity? These are the issues we're going to be looking at. What do you think, millennial?
Well, you set me up to be the fall guy, because that was a beautiful optimistic scenario. And I mean, you know, let's just be honest. What I've been seeing over the last 4 years, I define as political tribalism. Mm-hmm. Now, I've long known what tribalism is, or, you know, what it means to be a tribal society, because I studied history and I've taught world history. But only really in the last 4 years have I truly come to understand what tribalism is. Part of that was visiting the Balkans. And so understanding tribalism by definition versus experiencing it, that's the, you know, totally different thing. So here's what tribalism is. Tribalism is a society that's based on kinship, based on bloodline. And that's about as far as your empathy can go. You cannot empathize or understand those who are beyond your kinship, those who are beyond your bloodline. You look at other people, and if you see them doing something different from the way you do it, it's wrong. You don't understand it. Does that sound familiar? That kind of sounds like our political landscape. Political tribalism. What I'm seeing more and more is the lack of empathy, the lack of ability to understand the other side, why people vote the way they do. It's more or less seen as you're a moron if you don't think like I do. Mm. And a lot of this is driven from the top down. This is happening because of, here's a term that I learned a while ago, the osmosis of leadership. So if that's happening in the leadership, where they are basically at war with each other and they lack empathy and they don't understand each other, that's going to filter down to society. That's the main trend that I'm looking out for, is that political tribalism intensifying. It's really up to us, the American citizens, to not go down that path. If the parties want to go down that path and they want to battle it out, okay, but we don't have to be sucked into it. So that's the main thing that I'm looking at and concerned about in these coming weeks and coming months, is we know that neither side is going to concede. Even if it is a Biden victory, the Republicans aren't going to concede. If it's a Trump victory by, even a slim margin, the Democrats aren't going to. So do the people have to get sucked into that? I think it's really up to us to back away from that intensification, that political tribalism.
So, and I understand that, and I don't disagree. I'm taking the optimistic view. I think that Biden has the temperament and the empathy to try to transcend that tribalism. In fact, if that kind of tribalism is a top-down phenomenon, there's going to have to be an equal reaction from the top down to cure it. And one of the things that I'm going to recommend that he do is that there's a fellow who's written 3 books optimistic about America's future. One is about first globals, and the other is about neo-tribes and how to build some empathy among and cooperation among those tribes. And he can get those books for only 99 cents now these days. I think we've said a lot.
Yeah, I think we have. And we'll be back next week, and we'll probably know a little bit more, although I don't think that everything will be resolved by next week.
God willing. Bye-bye, everybody.
Take care.